this week solitude and next week community perhaps. And I think about those two ideas, and often we set these things up as opposites. We put them in competition with one another. And I actually believe if you understood solitude correctly, you would realize that solitude is actually a commitment to community in a very special way. Because what happens when you start to appreciate solitude and fuel your life off moments of being apart from or separated from the world, then you start to become better for the world when you're engaging the world. And so I'm not talking about an introvert who wants to run away from the world. I'm saying even people who love the world and love community and love being with people will be better for people if they learn to be apart from people at times and learn to separate themselves. Hey, welcome, Valley Sue. It's good to see you. New mom. Awesome to see you here. Where's the baby? She's hiding somewhere. There at the back. Our newest member. Give a two-fingered clap. That's so sweet. Okay, sorry, I was just distracted there for a moment, but I'm always celebrating church growth, even when it's internal. And we didn't evangelize, we just multiplied. That's wonderful. I've done that for the church. That's probably my biggest contribution with growing the church numbers. Just have more kids, you know. So solitude, it's not an either or between being with people and enjoying community and being alone and dealing with the things about solitude. So my first point is, in order to prepare for the right attitude for solitude, You need to know that the material world is not all there is. For me, solitude as a spiritual discipline is actually about recognizing that there's a material world which is real. I'm not a cosmic humanist that describes everything as spirit, but actually the material world is real, and it's busy and it's loud and it's full, and it assaults your senses. You've got smell and sight and hearing and touch and taste, your five senses, and that's where the world actually gets to you. It reaches your consciousness through all your senses, and you don't have to go looking for it. It comes looking for you. But there's another component of our lives which is spiritual, and the spiritual is, in a sense, it's a little more ethereal, it's a little more mysterious, and it's a little less visible, because God himself, who is spirit, is totally invisible. So he doesn't generally just pop in front of you and say, "Here I am." If he did, I'm sure you'd give him attention. But the thing is, because he's not competing for your attention, God is often neglected in your life. So it starts by realizing the material world is not all there is. And 2 Peter 3 verse 10 says, "The day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar." That means the universe. "The elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be laid bare. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be?" In other words, because the universe is going to be destroyed at the end, what kind of a life should you live? That's really what Peter's asking you to consider. Consider how you spend your time in light of the fact that all this shall burn. Well, it doesn't mean you can treat it like a trash heap. I still believe in the stewardship of nature. I still believe in humanitarian good works. But there's a part of this that has to sink in, that everything we're living in is temporary and passing. So what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. But in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness. So then, dear friends, since you are looking forward to this, make every effort to be found spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. The cataclysm of the second coming, that's when Jesus returns, and how all we know will burn, well, the implication of that is that the material world is temporary. To say it's temporary doesn't mean it's unimportant. It is important. The world is real, and that's where you live. But it's not all that there is. And so sometimes it fills our natural senses to the point that it's all we see. But there's a time when we need to simplify our focus, and we must learn to live as if we are in this world but not of it. So we work, we plant, we reap, we raise kids, we build, but we need to do all this with an eternal perspective. This world is not our lasting home. The material creation that we know is temporary, and our true and eternal home is not in this world. So that's my first point, because when you start to realize there's something to seek beyond what you can touch and see, then you start to say, I would prioritize spiritual components of my life. I would give some time to non-stimulus, if you like, to something which isn't coming at me like an iPod playing a soundtrack. You say, solitude isn't just going to the forest to be overwhelmed by nature. It's not just going out there to reconnect with the birds and the trees and hear the tranquil sounds of a stream. It's something beyond that that I'm talking about. There's something beyond the quiet of a forest that has to connect with you at a spiritual level, or you have to connect with. There's something more to your life than just even resting and getting a holiday where you get refreshed. I'm not talking about just rest and refreshment. I'm talking about being alone. Now, we need solitude. My second point is we need solitude, but it's a rare commodity. Solitude is actually something hard to find. It's rare. It's like a diamond. You don't just open the ground and find a diamond. You actually have to search for it. And in this world, the busy world we're part of, you actually don't get solitude easily. This world is actually quite loud. And I was reading up about solitude, and I see the psychologists describe solitude as a basic human need, and they say sleep is your first form of solitude, where you actually switch off to people. So sleep is a form of solitude. It's not the only form of solitude that you should have, though. So if all you're doing to get away from people is sleeping, well, you may be depressed, or you may just be tired like I usually am, but sleep is good, and sleep is vitally important, and psychologists have been kind of trying to work out how to get good mental health. So all this could be just secular, you know, thought, not biblical. But how would you find good mental health? And one of the things you need to discipline yourself in solitude, is having enough sleep. So how much sleep do you need? Apparently, we're all wrong when we assess ourselves. I say I need about 6 hours of sleep, and I can get by on 6 hours of sleep. In that case, actually, I need about 7.5 hours of sleep. They've done tests and worked out most of us overestimate how strong we are and underestimate our need for sleep. And so you say, oh, no, I'm fine with 6 hours, which means you should probably get 7 or 7.5 hours of sleep. Sleep is something sacred. It's something valuable. And when you go through a season of having insomnia or battling to sleep, suddenly it becomes all the more precious. And at 4:45 in the morning, I hear this guy whistling somewhere outside in the field. And he comes whistling before the sun's even up. And I don't know if he's whistling for his car to come to him, or if he's whistling for someone to open a gate for him, or if he's calling the geese. I don't know what he's doing, but he whistles loudly. And he is a sleep thief. And his disrespect has become the robbery of my solitude. Now, you have to look at how you live life, because you could be a sleep thief. Now, if you're a baby, sorry for you guys, dedim, no sleep in your house. Babies are sleep thieves. But we need to look at how we live and say, okay, are we respecting how God made us? This is actually in the Bible. In Psalm 127, verse 2, it says, in vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat. For he grants sleep to those he loves. God gives you sleep and fruitfulness. But what we do is, with God out of the picture, we work, work, socialize, socialize, work, socialize, until maybe close to midnight, and then by 4 in the morning, some guy is bringing his ox cart into town, and I can just hear those clippity-clop hooves going across the lake, and you can't sleep anymore after 4 or 4:30 because someone else is making a noise. You can't sleep much before midnight because someone's having a party, and then every 3 weeks someone's having a funeral, and then it's just like all night long. And in a way, there's a part of us that's saying we're constructing a life without considering God's patterns for life. And a lot of the toil is anxious toil. It's like we won't have enough, so we better get to market first. I would love to see the guy of faith who arrives late with his zebu cart and believes God will still help him sell all his produce. Anyway, then I'll be angry with him for being in the traffic when I'm trying to drive. In vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat, for he grants sleep to those he loves. Now, that applies in that community, which is more rural, but in our modern society, there's similar vanities. We're pursuing relationship we don't need. We're pursuing entertainment we don't have to have. We're on Facebook at 11 at night or whatever. And I think one of the civilized guys like Charles Spurgeon from a generation gone by, someone before my time, he said, all decent gentlemen retire by 10 p.m. Means you go to sleep before 10 p.m., otherwise you're not a decent gentleman. You're not a good man. You party animals. Anyway, those of you. So my point is, we need to start to prioritize the order of our lives so that we actually rightly energized, so that we're not tired all the time. People who are tired all the time live a mura-mura life in the daytime because their efficiency can't be at a peak because they've squandered themselves during the 24 hours of the day. Whether it was just staying out too late with friends or whether it's a constant pattern of working too late at the office and letting your boss exploit you, there's something you have to build in your life which has a pattern, a rhythm, a health to it, and many of us ignore all of that. And we don't put those patterns and those rhythms in place. We don't honor the Word of God. We don't recognize how He's made us, and we're living basically as worn out, tired out people who aren't very productive or efficient in the daytime. And you can excuse it. I mean, I remember Bill Gates. This really fascinated me. He said he doesn't go to church on a Sunday. He says, just in terms of allocation of time resources, religion is not very efficient. Then he explains, there's a lot more I could be doing on a Sunday morning. That was published years ago in Time magazine, and it was actually an interview, I think, with Rolling Stone magazine. But he said that, and he's basically known to play a game of golf on a Sunday morning, or perhaps years ago he did that. And someone wrote back to Time magazine, you can write letters in, and that guy's letter was printed, and he just said, kind of, to Bill Gates, I'm not sure that I really understand how you calculate your return on investment. When you say it's not a good investment of your time to be in church, he says, the person wrote, I can't understand how a finite investment for an infinite return can be a bad return on investment. So that person writing in had recognized that there are eternal things and there are earthly things. And Bill Gates hadn't recognized that. He hadn't recognized yet that there's eternity, and he should be making his calculation in the light of how he's investing for eternity. Now, when it comes to solitude, it's the same kind of idea. When you start to recognize that it can do something that changes matters pertaining to the spirit and matters pertaining to eternity, then stopping and taking time out becomes valuable. It becomes worth it. But until you see that this calculation needs to factor in eternity, you won't think it's worth it just to spend an hour doing nothing. And it's possible, actually, to spend an hour in solitude in the midst of a crowd. I believe if I lived in New York and there were thousands and millions and multiple millions around me, I could still find solitude. I could go and sit somewhere and people could be walking past the whole time and I could just sit by myself on a bench in solitude. But what solitude is it's not engaging with the things of this world. So solitude isn't listening to your iPod, jogging. That's not solitude. Solitude isn't reading a book. It may be an attempt at blocking the world, but it's not true solitude. True solitude is actually, initially appears to be a disconnecting from everything. It's not reading, it's not praying so much. It's just being alone with your thoughts. And apparently that's very scary. Apparently being alone with your thoughts is very, very scary. While I was preparing this sermon, I was reading some research on solitude, and they did an experiment. The psychologists, they have so much fun. They took a group of people and they told them their test was to do nothing. And we're talking these like over-motivated, you know, consumer, secular, humanist, materialist New Yorkers, no doubt. Some guys who are running the treadmill of the rat race, trying to make money and utilize every hour of their day productively. So they said to those guys, you're not allowed to look at your phone, you're not allowed to read an email, you're not allowed to listen to your iPod, you just have to sit in this room on your own, or go home and spend an hour completely on your own. The people that did that came back, and about 30% admitted that they failed. They just couldn't do it. They had to check their email. They couldn't make 1 hour on their own doing nothing. Then the others, they put in a room and they tested them and they said, like, just sit there. Like you guys now, I know it's hard. And the guys couldn't sit still. They had a paper in front of them and some of them broke the rules. The rules were do nothing, and some of them started doing origami. They had to fold that piece of paper because just doing nothing was too hard for them. But the most peculiar was the guy, there were a few of them that actually showed signs of being unable to deal with being by themselves. They put an electrode on them. I don't know where. I don't want to know where. A shocking electrode. That if that guy pressed a button, he could deliver himself a painful shock, a jolt. It was measured. They tested it in advance to show the guy. Each person had to try it out. That's not pleasant. None of them thought it felt good, okay? None of the guys thought that shock felt good. But then when given an hour by themselves, some of the guys shocked themselves, and one guy shocked himself 265 times in that hour. The psychologists conclude that they'd rather administer electric shocks to themselves than be left alone with their own thoughts. What are you scared of? Why is it scary to be alone? It's not loneliness that people are scared of. Anyway, to get true solitude, you have to leave distractions and inputs and so on. You've got to also leave temptations. I noticed that sometimes, you know, just being alone isn't good. If you're alone at the wrong time, like when David was on the roof of his palace, it wasn't the time for solitude. It was the time that kings were going off to war, and David saw Bathsheba. So solitude isn't about putting yourself in a place where you get tempted to sin. Solitude actually has to be very, very intentional. Otherwise, you might be tempted. You know, I could kid myself in the evening, I have an hour of solitude. Yeah, but sometimes it's really not solitude. Sometimes it's an hour of watching a movie or watching YouTube videos. That's also refreshing, but it's not the same as solitude. So here's why solitude is scary. In solitude, you discover who you really are. In fact, you have to face who you really are. In solitude, you're confronted with yourself, and only yourself, until you get quiet enough to really hear and realize that God is also there. But initially, it's just you and the wall, you and the room, you and the forest, or wherever you are. And there's a quote just to lighten up this serious moment. It's by Jean-Paul Sartre. He said, "If you are lonely when you are alone, you are in bad company." If you're lonely when you're alone, you're in bad company. Anyway, so you shouldn't be lonely when you're alone. The point of a healthy solitude is you've actually come to terms with who you are. But the scary part about solitude is you might not be satisfied with your own company. You might discover you don't like your own company. And this is what solitude does. It shows who you truly are. Because in almost every other scene, every other moment of life, you are to some degree or other an actor. to some degree or other, you actually know you have an audience. You realize you're conscious that there are people around you, and so you modify your behavior. You're a little more self-conscious. You're a little more on your guard when you're around people or when people could just be around. But in solitude, when no one is around, you can pick your nose and you can fart without remorse, with no fear of rebuke or reprimand. You know, the other day we were watching some TV and then suddenly it's like something was stinking. And in the living room, the boys turn to each other and then the accusations start flying. Jim, was that you? Justin, was that you? And actually, it was Joelle, anyway. She's sleeping now, so I can say that. We were all shocked. She's in the runnings. She's competing like one of the boys. The issue is to lift the level of the intellectual stuff here to a proper level. Os Guinness said this: character then is what we are when no one sees except God. So character is what you are when no one else sees. That's who you truly are. And in order to know your true self, you have to be alone. My finest thoughts have come to me when I'm alone. Some of the most wonderful thoughts I've ever had, most lofty ideas have come to me when I'm alone. And some of my worst moments, the things I'm most ashamed of, have been when I'm alone. So that's why it's scary to be alone, because you don't know what you're going to get. Are you going to discover something bad about yourself? But you need to discover it. I am a sinner. I need to be willing to admit that before God. I have to know the baseness of my humanity. I have to come to terms with sometimes the ugly stuff. But solitude also has enabled me to have some of the greatest dreams, the best thoughts, the coolest ideas, and make me feel like there's a reason for being alive. And that's what solitude does. It starts to make you realize why you're alive. The rest of the time you're busy living, but you sometimes lose sight of why you're living. You're just running that treadmill, feeding the kids, washing clothes, doing the dishes, and going round and round and round and round, endless cycles of output. So solitude is now, you'll be able to see, if solitude can show you who you really are, and if you wait long enough, you'll also discover that God is there, then solitude is also about connection. Community is about connecting to one another, and solitude is about connecting to yourself and to God. And so we mustn't see it as one is good and one is bad. When you pause, it's like viewed negatively because you're dialing out from the world, and the world is the real thing, and this is the half-time, you know, break. That's a wrong thinking. It's a wrong thinking to think that you're only disconnecting from the world when you're in solitude. It's a wrong thinking to think that it's the tea break before you get back to the real thing. See, solitude isn't a tea break or a refreshment break before you get back to the real thing. Solitude simply gives you access to another part of reality. Solitude is connecting to yourself and connecting to God, not the rest of the time you're connecting to society and people. And so if you understand that, you'll realize that solitude is actually necessary for you to connect correctly to other people. Because if you don't ever commit to solitude, you're never going to draw what you need there, so you're never going to have it when you need it for the community. And so solitude, actually someone who withdraws from their sphere for a moment is actually making them a bigger blessing to their sphere in the end. For that reason, I have learned to delight in when Sue goes off to be by herself. If she takes a book and goes and reads, good for her. Even better if she gets up at 4:30 in the morning before the rest of the house is awake and she has probably the only hour of her day when no one's demanding something from her. That's her hour of solitude. My hour of solitude doesn't happen at 4:30 in the morning. That's my hour of anger at guys who whistle. That's my hour of trying to get my last hour of sleep. But I come, you know, I draw apart from the family at about 9 at night. By the time the kids are in bed, Sue's usually asleep. I can't sleep because I'm a night person. I get up, I go, and I be by myself. Again, that's the only hour I'm really by myself. Now, if Sue thought I was being an unloving husband because I didn't stay with her in bed, you know, it would be unfair on me. I need that hour by myself, and she needs that hour by herself. So to those of you who are living with other people, give them room to find solitude. They're not rejecting you. They're actually taking time out to be better for you. So solitude is that important, but it's not easily found, and it's scary because you have to come to terms with who you are. Jesus practiced solitude. This is my fourth point. As Jesus, I'm going to read Luke 5, verse 15. Jesus has been ministering healing. He's been with people. So Luke 5, verse 15 says, "The news about him spread all the more, so that crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses." And then in Luke 5, verse 16, it says, "But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed." He often withdrew from people to lonely places and prayed. So I see in Jesus a model of withdrawing from people even though you're there for people. He came for the people, he healed the sick, but as his fame grew and more people came, he didn't say, "Oh look, more responsibility, I need to give more to them." He actually withdrew often. And so as your business grows, or as your family grows, as the pressures on your life get bigger and bigger, as you're entrusted with success and you're entrusted with promotion, you may have to figure out how to become more determined or intentional about withdrawing in order to find solitude. That's what Jesus did. As the news about him spread all the more, crowds of people came to hear him, but Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. He also drew aside before big decisions. In Luke 6, verse 12, it says, "One of those days Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray, and he spent the night praying to God. When morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he designated apostles." So when you're facing a big decision, withdraw into solitude and just give yourself some space. Because otherwise, how do we make our decisions? Oh, what would you do? Give me your advice. We have a conversation with one another. We get perspective. We try to make the decision by getting input, by weighing things up, by doing our planning and everything. But Jesus went up a mountainside and he was by himself, alone, for a whole night in that time. And then he came and picked his disciples. He also carved out the time when he had to, meaning carving is hard work. You take a sharp blade and you cut wood. It's not just automatic. In Mark 1:35, it says, "Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed." I don't know, maybe you have to find your solitary place by locking a door. Maybe you have to find a solitary place by asking someone not to disturb you. But you have to carve it out. You have to make that time. It doesn't just always, it doesn't fit in easily in the day normally. And Jesus is an example of an early riser and staying up late at times, praying at night. Sometimes he went off to pray at night. Sometimes he got up early to pray. I think in there, it's maybe it's freedom for people not to feel that it's only in the morning that you have to have your spiritual moment. You can have a spiritual moment with God at the end of the day. And in fact, I've seen that from around the era of the Puritans, they used to teach people morning and evening. And that's why Charles Spurgeon's daily devotions is actually morning by morning and evening by evening. They're two volumes. But I only read morning by morning because I just prefer the content of that one. And often I read it in the evening as well. So look at Jesus a bit more. Look at how he practices solitude. In the gospel that Matthew presents, Jesus feeds 5,000 men, excluding women and children. He does this massive miracle. He's with thousands and thousands of people. He's doing ministry. He's outputting. Okay, Jesus is very capable. He's a miracle worker. He feeds 5,000. Then it says in Matthew 14, verse 22, immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. So he said to his disciples, sail away. Then he said to the crowds, veluma, next time, off you go. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. There's the solitude. The boat was already a considerable distance from the land, buffeted by the waves, and the wind was against it. During the fourth watch of the night, so late into the night, early morning actually, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. So, what fascinates me about this account is Jesus is able to feed 5,000 people. That's like, wow. I mean, that's super miracle stuff. Jesus is able to walk on water. Wow, Jesus, you're awesome. None of us can do that. We don't walk on water. We don't feed 5,000 without God doing a miracle. So here's Jesus, miracle and miracle. But right in between, he dismisses the crowd and he goes off to be alone. You see, there's something there that you can't get miraculously. You can't just ask God to give you what solitude gives you. You have to endure solitude. So you might be sitting here and saying, God, won't you refresh me? Or God, won't you, you know, energize me? Or God, won't you give me vision? Or God, won't you? You can't get it. It's not going to come as a miraculous deposit from heaven. You actually have to draw aside and have the solitude. See, that Jesus did that. He did a miracle, then he had solitude, then he did a miracle. He couldn't even get what solitude gives miraculously. He had to get it through being in solitude. So that should encourage you that even Jesus had to take time aside, and you aren't going to get it any other way. So if there's some component of your life that's missing, sometimes we're praying, God, do that supernaturally, just recharge my battery. But God's saying, the way that comes isn't by the miraculous, that comes by you spending an hour in solitude, and then you'll have that. So some final thoughts. It's intentional separation, and in that time, what you usually get is a deeper knowledge of who you are. And while you wait, I don't think solitude means you're praying the whole time. I don't think it's solitude when my Malagasy pastor friends get up at 4 a.m. and they go ba 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 ba, pretending to speak in tongues for an hour. That's not solitude. It achieves something, and I'm sure praying is good, but what I'm talking about is different. It's just being alone, being apart. You're not focusing on nothing. You're aware that God is there. It's a spiritual exercise. It's not a Zen exercise. It's not empty to be empty. It's empty to be filled. You know the difference? So Christians, we empty ourselves out not because empty is better, but because full is better if we're full of God. So in solitude, there is an emptying, but with an expectation that something's going to happen in your soul. Something God is going to do. It's not a focus on nothing, but if you focus on something, then it's on God or it's on your own thoughts. At the end, it's not disconnection, it's another form of connection. You're not going to connect with nature. Actually, for some people, nature mustn't be your God. Don't demand that solitude has to be in a forest. You could find solitude locked in your room at home. Solitude is different from connecting with nature. Although it can help to go into nature to find solitude. But don't be distracted by nature. It's like you're going to connect with God, but you're not prescribing how that's going to feel or how fast you're going to feel God's presence or if you're going to feel His presence. And solitude without God is probably just daydreaming. Fasting without prayer is dieting. Dieting isn't bad and daydreaming isn't bad. Dieting can be great and Daydreaming's great, but there's a step further. Prayer and fasting, solitude and connecting. Connecting with God in some way. Then, when you come to terms with it, you're actually make something's going to change. You're going to get inspiration. You're going to get fresh vision. You're going to get something that you can't get anywhere else. An introvert might want to camp in solitude. That's not what solitude is about. Solitude isn't about going and living there in the wilderness. You're not becoming a monk. You don't camp in solitude. The introvert would love to stay there forever and make solitude a god. But you're actually supposed to go back to community again, and that's what hopefully George will preach on next Sunday. So solitude should actually fuel your usefulness in community. Solitude should make you a better person for all the other people you have to connect with, because you've been connecting to something outside of and beyond. See, this is why that has to happen. Because a beautiful thought never shared is meaningless. So if God inspires you in solitude, then you come back and you share that with others. A beautiful painting never seen is never enjoyed. So if there's something beautiful about what God's going to do in your time of solitude, it's actually because that's going to come back to community and be shared with others. So solitude is for resourcing community with all the best things that community cannot produce in itself. See, not everything is found in team. Not everything comes out of work and out of labor. There's something else that community can't produce, and it's found in solitude. Solitude will help you get strong and be less focused on yourself when you're around others, because then it's time to connect with them. And that's the other problem. Some of us are so undernourished ourselves in solitude that when we're with people, we see them as the enemy. We've got nothing left to give them, and we don't want to connect with them. But you're supposed to connect with them. But you can't connect with them if you never connected with yourself. You never connected with God. And interestingly, God is reflected in both solitude and community, because He is one and He is three. And the very word solitude comes from a root which means to become one. So make time for solitude. In this sense, a quiet time can be meditative, just sitting and thinking in the presence of God without even obsessing about how present God feels. And slowly, in the quiet, you'll discover that He is there, and that He is giving you vision, and He is doing something inside your soul, and He is giving you creativity, and He is giving you energy. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we see in Your word how Jesus would go away and be alone. And some of us are scared to be alone. We're scared of letting go of the busyness and the work. We're scared of our own thoughts. We feel bored, we feel restless, and we haven't learned how to live without being distracted by other things. God, as a church, as a people, help us to learn the discipline of solitude. Help us to learn how to set ourselves apart and be alone, and in that place to connect with ourselves and to connect with You. In Jesus' name, amen.